CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm one of your hosts, Hale, and with me again is Brandon. Following what we've done a few times now with the two of us on the show, I was thinking of kind of following a little bit of a formula that we have. I've been reading out for a while various essays from the Modern Ethics and 77 Arguments, which is a collection basically from the New York Times, The Stone, which is their philosophy-related periodical. For our listeners out there, it's got a lot of great, generally quite short essays on a large variety of topics from pretty well-distinguished thinkers. They're primarily professors of philosophy at various universities, but there's a few journalists and anthropologists and people in there, but very much philosophy-related arguments. And so we decided to pick apart another one of those and sort of follow what I think is an interesting argument, but then also follow some wider implications of what the actual argument is and the kind of genre of philosophy as well. So we're looking at The Sacred and the Humane by Annette Bildzetsky. Annette is a professor of philosophy at Tel Aviv University in Israel, and they also work quite significantly with human rights NGOs and have a lot of background in that field, obviously, one that's been quite, especially in that part of the world, been quite pertinent as of late. The thrust of this essay, we're going to go through it with you primarily. We're going to basically, just for our listeners know, over the first half of the episode, we're going to kind of go through the essay, go through the basic argument, and then we're going to kind of unleash more of a free-flowing discussion on the second half. But the bottom line of the essay is, what are the legitimate origins of human rights? Like the why, what grounds them? And the particularly, and that's looking at the relationship between religious justifications for human rights and secular justifications for human rights. And so just to start off with the article itself, Annette describes human rights as, "Human rights, as we all know them, are the rights humans are due simply by virtue of being human." So just to read that again, human rights, as we all know, are the rights humans are due simply by virtue of being human. She then follows on and says, but there is nothing simple here, since both human and rights are concepts in need of investigation. So again, the simplest, you know, distinction is that human rights, you have them simply because you're a human being. That's the bottom line. But, you know, what counts as a human, who counts as a human, when, that sort of thing, and what those rights are certainly very contentious still today and have been basically since people started discussing human rights during the Enlightenment period, and then obviously more thoroughly in the 20th century. Since there's a lot of discussion about the religious versus secular in this article, I thought it'd be good to get a really good account of what Annette is talking about in terms of religion. She uses the definition, religion is a system of myth and ritual. It is a communal system of propositional attitudes, beliefs, hopes, fears, desires that are related to superhuman agents. So just to read that one more time, religion is a system of myth and ritual. It is a communal system of propositional attitudes, beliefs, hopes, fears, and desires, and perhaps the most important part for our discussion, that are related to superhuman agents. So gods, mythical forces, all that kind of stuff. Okay, why does this really matter? Like, what's the actual discussion here? Because as Annette points out, or what's the actual problem here? As Annette points out, many people who you would on the surface think about advocating for and being very involved in human rights advocacy are also very religious. Annette uses the example of a well-known, at least at the time, by the way, this article is from 2011, so things might have changed a little bit in terms of specific details. But, for example, there's a rabbi in Israel who is very involved in, you know, rejecting Israeli government claims to places like the West Bank in terms of settlement and that kind of thing, and would go out and, you know, basically stand in the way of bulldozers or soldiers, Israeli soldiers. This is a rabbi, you know, because he feels and his organization feels that, you know, the expulsion of Palestinians from those lands is unjust, right? A very similar activity that Annette and other people have done with NGOs within Israel that are effectively against things like settlement in the West Bank and that kind of thing, right? And you see that kind of stuff all over the world, right? You see religious groups in particular advocating for the oppressed or people who are being harmed in some way, in ways that more secular NGOs and theorists and all that kind of stuff are also advocating for. The ends and are effectively the same. If you would agree, Brandon, that's kind of like the problem that we're getting is like, okay, we're talking about human rights here, where they originate from. You've got all sorts of people approaching human rights from different areas, or supposedly approaching human rights from different areas or different avenues, but they're all kind of doing the same thing. What's the problem? First of all, I think let's take the religious perspective that Annette does, or at least examine it a little bit. You know, one religious author wrote that the essence of all morality is this: to believe that every human being is of infinite importance and therefore that no consideration of expediency can justify the oppression of one by another. But to believe that this is necessary to believe in God. I'll read that one more time. The essence of all morality is this: to believe that every human being is of infinite importance and therefore that no consideration of expediency can justify the oppression of one by another. But to believe this, it is necessary to believe in God. So you've got another succinct or relatively succinct definition of human rights, basically, or their origins, especially in relationship to why oppression is immoral and should be fought against. But the main part that human beings are, each individual human being is of infinite importance, is sort of buttressed by this idea that the infinite component, many people, authors will call it the sacred component of human beings, is to basically believe in that, to be committed to that, requires some kind of religious or supernatural belief. You have to have some sort of belief system that says basically, that commands effectively, that hey, people are special. People are, you know, they're specialer. That's not a real word, by the way, audience. But then stones or even animals or plants or whatever it might be, right? That human beings have a privileged, sacred place and of infinite importance. And that many religious authors, well, basically all of them, will say that that's because of God or gods of some kind.
Yeah, I've sometimes wondered about how it is that there is this transference of the significance of human beings or any given sacred being in the universe, how that follows from the fact of God's existence or of being created by some kind of supernatural or spiritual agent. But I'm kind of just having the thought right now that I wonder if the reason is because if something like human rights asserts that human beings are of paramount or infinite or special consideration, the question does arise, how does the special get in there? How does the sacred get in there? Something sacred has to exist in order to explain the appearance of the sacred in something like human rights. And so I don't know if that explains the special relation between humans and their supernatural agents that create them or exist in their image or something like that. But you do need to explain where value is. You do need to explain how does value, how does the sacred, how does what is good or what is worth living for or something like that, where does that come from? And for that, it seems like one way to do that is to have a sacred or religious component that you can say, this is where it comes from.
Yeah, and I do, to step away from the text momentarily, I do think that you've hit upon a point that I kind of agree with. For audience, by the way, I'm not religious, so, you know, keep that in mind as I posit my own sort of opinions and beliefs. But basically, I do think that being a human being, especially now, but frankly still now, is very, like, confusing. It's a very odd thing. And you do, like, there is something at least unique about being human. Like, obviously, we could do a whole series or podcast on, you know, on the being of human being. But, you know, you're not, like, for our listeners, I presume, you're not, like, inanimate object. You know, you're not a stone, you're not a tree, you're not your car. You're this aware being rolling around in the world that's temporal and has all these different relationships, and it's very odd, but it's also kind of special. And I do think that there is a component sometimes of the religious argument, or I have at least a suspicion, that it's basically a post ad hoc fallacy, where it's basically like, I'm special, therefore, or we're special, therefore, like, something special must have created us, right? Yeah, that is equal to or greater than our own specialness. And that's, like, kind of a version of, like, the ontological argument a little bit. Like, I see myself as special, therefore, like, there has to be something beyond me that's more special that makes that, you know, even that recognition possible. I don't think it's a particularly good argument, if I'm being honest, but I do have a suspicion that in some ways that's a little bit of what's going on. And as people, I think one thing I definitely think that's generally true about human beings is we love answers, and we love simple answers to big questions. We don't do well with the anxiety of the unknown. And so, you know, seeing ourselves as special, feeling quite odd and unique, having that sort of, like, existential reflection and being able to say that there's something greater than myself that allows that, or, like, creates that taking place in the first place, is very, like, succinct. It's a very nice, well, tied up unit. And I think that's what we're going to see a little bit too here, like, as we go on with Annette. That's basically the argument that people put forward, right? That there's got to be some kind of religious, spiritual underpinning to this whole thing that we call life that makes, you know, humans valuable, right? That gives some value to us. And that can come from various different religious systems, but that's basically the bottom line. But they also say, gets to, I think, a larger argument we're going to have in a little bit. But when secular ideas come forth and start to try and ground human rights in some kind of way, the automatic retort is that basically what they're doing is just rebranding the religious argument, right? They're rebranding the spiritual component into something that sounds more philosophical, but it's ultimately just as ephemeral as any sort of, like, religious belief. To read actually what Annette says, this is the religious response to a lot of, or at least a lot of more basic secular arguments around human rights. On this view, any highfalutin philosophical concept that is called upon to be a comparable base for human rights is no more than a religious foundation clothed in secular garb. It is really just God by another name. And then the idea of human rights in a religious book by Michael Perry is unequivocal about the worthlessness of the secular bunch of arguments by saying, there is, finally, no intelligible, much less persuasive, secular version of the conviction that every human being is sacred. the only intelligible versions are religious. So we can think of conspicuous elements in the vocabulary of human rights, like notions like particularly dignity, inviolability, being an end in themselves. Basically, these, as Annette states, these highfalutin philosophical terms ultimately are just rebrandings of that, you know, that special spiritual givenness that human beings have that give them value, right? Like, what does it really mean to have, like, dignity as a human being? Why would I be imbued with that kind of dignity as a human being just, you know, by innately being me or you, whoever it's going to be, right? How am I specifically an end in myself, right? What's that sort of, like, structure emanating from in terms of being, like, a, like, most basic moral grounds for action, right? And again, just like a lot of the religious side of the argument will basically say that, you know, you're basically just taking very similar structures and reworking them to sound more secular, but ultimately they are left with a kind of unanswered spirit, like, grounding that used to be all tied up neatly by, like, a religious vision, but now are either just kind of concealing that or are kind of left hanging at the end, right? Like, you build a structure that doesn't really feel like it's finished.
Yeah, it doesn't have the same kind of sense of anchoring that a transcendental answer has. And it seems to be, for my part, I feel like it seems to be a part of the, what I want to say, it's a product of the instrument that constructs it. If what is going to found or ground something like a rational, enlightened, secular human rights is going to be something like rationality or appeal to our human consciousness or something like that. Well, there seems to be something about human thought, human rationality that is always churning, that is always in motion. When we think, we essentially subject something to doubt. When we are thinking, we take any certainty and we start thinking about it. If we're not just contemplating it or being in awe of it or being subjected to it, we are kind of pushing its buttons and we're asking, okay, well, what is this? What are its parts? How does it work? So a rational grounding for something like human rights seems like it's inherently going to have a slippery basis. It's always going to lack the solidity that the transcendental answer has, just by virtue of what we're founding it on.
We enter a thorny area, and we're going to get into what Annette has to say a little bit. To be honest, I don't think her answer is complete, at least not in this essay. But it's more the virtue of, you know, the more secular systems. But there is, as we'll talk a little bit, I'm sure we'll talk a little bit later, this notion that, like, once you enter the secular realm, you are also somewhat, you're committing to never being fully committed. Because then you're entering a kind of, like, dogmatic realm. Now, you could be very, 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 very close to that. There are many things that seem ultimately certain, but especially with something like human rights and the theoretical basis for that and those sorts of structures, things are always being revitalized. Things are always being reworked, being, you know, kind of, you know, reformed. And that's, I think, coming back to the more religious side of things, is one of the nicer components of the religious relationship to human rights, which we're going to get into a little bit more, but where you do have ground. Like, you've got bedrock, you're there, you hit God, you hit the scriptures, you hit whatever it's going to be, and you say, okay, this is why we act this way, and we can remain steadfast in our beliefs going forward, and I don't have to doubt, right? Like, we're removing that component of the equation, and that's comfortable, and frankly, there's probably times when it's also more effective. On some level, because there is that, like, we can just fully commit, we can believe, you know, we're not going to have people who are kind of wishy-washy on what to do or what not to do. This is a commandment from God. We're all, like, on the same page. But to come back to where Annette's going with this, basically, I'll go through basically what Annette actually has to say. But as to our last point, where, for example, Mike Perry was saying that basically, if you're going to believe in, you know, in the sacredness of the human being, you have to have religious reasons for doing so. Annette says basically this, there is no philosophically robust reason to accept this claim. True, the religious answer is straightforward and clear cut, which is exactly what we're just talking about. Straightforward, clear cut, succinct. That's great. True, philosophical theorizing on the foundation of human rights in particular and morality in general may be complex or nuanced or even convoluted. So again, what we were just talking about, it's not clear cut like the religious explanation is. True, the word sacred carries religious connotations, but that could be a manner of speaking, and dignity and inviolability certainly do not need to be tied down to the sacred. So maybe we just need to toss the sacred out. Maybe that's too religious of language. And then Annette has this to say. Aristotelian virtue and natural justice, or the Kantian categorical imperative arising from reason, of course, offer philosophical basis for morality at large. Theories of human needs, human interests, and human agency provide analytic foundations for the idea of human rights. And then there is Hart's one natural right, the equal right to be free. Gervais turned to human action of logic. Sen and Nussbaum's talk of basic human capabilities, and so on with many others, all affording a humanistic starting point for the human dignity at the base of human rights that need nary a wink at religion. We're kind of doing two things here. We're entering the humanistic argument. We're also accepting, though, when entering that humanistic argument, if you're going to pass through that doorway, that we can ground human rights in, you know, like theories and principles that don't rely upon religion and rely primarily on the human experience and our own agreed upon dignity as human beings from a secular perspective. But also, as you saw from that list, you're also entering a realm that is far more complicated. You have to, like, you can't, there's no more are we in this realm of like, there's one theory, there's one answer. You know, people will obviously commit more or less to certain perspectives. So people might even, like we talked about, either like essentially fully commit, but you are in a realm where you're basically saying, I have an argument. And my argument is this, these are my reasons, it's rational, it's logical, and therefore myself and you should be convinced by this system, which sorry for any religious listeners, is not the way religion works. Obviously, faith-based systems, at a certain point, you enter a world where it's basically like you believe.
So I find something kind of interesting about the discussion of nuance being kind of relegated to the secular, whereas in the sacred or in the religious, you have easy answers. It's God. God commands you to do something. It's interesting because I think about all of the theology that gets produced and all of the discussion that happens in these fields, all of the heresies and all of the schisms. So I think that there is a lot of work that gets done in religious law or in what God commands and whatnot, but there really is this question that seems to press people who are concerned with this, and it is, what does God want from us? It's not always clear. It's just that the virtue of the religious is that you do have some final endpoint. There really is someone who wants something from you. It's God, and you are to obey. You're at the behest of what God wants from you, or, you know, whatever transcendental command is being issued. It's on the side of the secular, it's still quite complicated. You are still going through all kinds of arguments. You know, what is the structure of human rationality such that we are respecting a human when we are respecting their rationality? That is part of the Kantian project. But it's just that it has less of a ground, it seems. It doesn't have that final stopping point. But the idea that it's more nuanced, well, it is more nuanced. There's a lot more people who seem to be putting chips on the table. There's Aristotelians and there's Kantians and there's utilitarians and there's just all kinds of people who are trying to ground how this stuff works. But we were always working through these problems. We were always moving between different experiences. We were always wondering, okay, well, that's what God says, but is that what God wants?
Even though Annette lists this whole, all these sorts of different systems for coming and grounding human rights within like a secular and humanistic framework, you know, there's effectively, although there's a very clear structural difference between religious and secular arguments, at least good secular arguments, there is this component where it's like, you know, the fight has been on for some time. Although, interestingly, Annette does point out that, and I think Annette is aware of this, because they also do point out, she also points out that at least from the statistics and data that we have, that religious people tend to agree a lot more on key social issues and moral problems than secular people do. Now, that's not really, like, look, obviously there's very significant disagreements, right? Like, history is full of religious, various kinds of religious wars and conflicts, both within large-scale religions and, you know, against each other. There does seem to be a lot more sort of consistency, at least from the information that Annette had put into the article. With the statistics that we have, it's clear that, like, at least it appears that that there's more consistency among religious people. Also, too, like, Annette's argument, as we're going to get into, is kind of, it goes a different direction in terms of, basically, there's a fundamental attack going on here against religiously motivated, quote-unquote, human rights-related persons, which I think is actually pretty sound. And it's probably pretty controversial, probably annoy a lot of people because, you know, human rights are important and people want to be involved. But basically, like, let's just hear from Annette herself. They start off by saying, I dare say that religion, even when indirectly in the service of human rights, is not really working for human rights. So going back to, let's say, the example of the religious, actually, let's take a different example. Let's take a really, like, intense one. During World War II, there were many priests and stuff like that who protected, you know, Jewish families, particularly Jewish children from the Nazis. You know, people would think that many people would describe this as a fantastic example of human rights in action, right? People standing up for human, you know, the sanctity of individuals' lives and, you know, their own personal freedom at great cost, personal risk to themselves. And Annette here is saying that they're not actually involved in doing human rights stuff if their motivations are religious, it should be said. If their motivations are religious. So go on. Although there is a recognition of the human as sacred, it is not the concept of rights that propels the religious person. For him or her, the human status of sacredness draws from a divine creation and directive, from man and woman having been created in God's image and therefore has nothing to do with human right. As Jack Donnelly says in Universal Human Rights, A Theory and Practice, traditional societies, quote-unquote traditional, so religious, spiritual, that kind of thing, typically have elaborate systems of duties, conceptions of justice, political legitimacy, human flourishing that sought to realize human dignity, flourishing or well-being entirely independent of human rights. These institutions and practices are alternative to, rather than different formulations of, human rights. So it's, the last part I think is super, super important. These institutions and practices are alternative to human rights. So basically, we come to the main component of this essay, the main argument, which is that human rights done from a religious perspective aren't actually human rights at all. Human rights work done from a religious perspective, a religious sort of emanation. It's not human rights work at all. It's effectively religious work is what it is. It's effectively spiritual work. It's religious work, gatekeeping of human rights, although I think it's probably well-founded on some level. But basically, and it's making the argument that human rights is a secular practice, it's a secular purview, and therefore religion doesn't really have, can't participate in that. Because it's not participating.